Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And welcome to this week's podcast. We're going to be talking politics as theater, as we do all the time. But first, hey, just a quick little mention of a book signing I'll be involved in this coming weekend. It's for the Chicago Pet Project, and perhaps you're familiar with that, the Chicago Pet Project book, which is all about raising money to get rid of puppy mills and to help those dogs who are born in them. It's going to be on December 11th, Sunday, December 11th. So if you're hearing this prior to that time, it'll be at the Virtu Bookstore, V-I-R-T-U, Virtu Bookstore at 2035 North Damon in Bucktown area. You'll meet Carrie Myers, who's the head of the Puppy Mill Project. You'll meet Karen Morgan, who's the incredible photographer who did the work. And myself and others who are featured as Chicago celebrities with our pets in the book will be there signing our pages. I'll probably be there from noon to 2 or so, but the event is from 11 to 3, 2035 North Damon, Virtu Bookstore, the Chicago Pet Project book, where you can buy the book, meet everybody involved, get a few of us to sign it, and there you have it. What a great Christmas gift it will be. Well, let's turn to politics now. Donald Trump making news almost every day when we wake up. It's a matter of what did he do last night and what did he have to say. So I wanted to explore that with a professor who understands all of this and its implications. David Dougherty is an assistant professor of political science at Loyola University, Chicago, where he teaches courses on American politics, political behavior. So let's see if he can make sense out of what's going on here. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
And, of course, it's always good to have you on Politics Tonight. Now we get to talk on the podcast. So much to talk about, but I want to start in the world of international relations. Trump, of course, recently creating a kerfuffle by accepting a phone call from the president of Taiwan when the United States, for the last 40 years, has had a one-China policy. His people say, nothing to see, folks. Move on. Nothing but a congratulatory phone call. Get over it. Others not so sure. What do you think? What are the implications and are there dangers in a president-elect sort of seemingly going willy-nilly or maybe not in terms of addressing and dealing with foreign leaders?
Well, I think there are certainly risks involved. I mean, the response from the diplomatic community was pretty clear. I think there's a lot of nervousness about a president-elect who has virtually no experience in the domain of foreign policy, casually taking chatty phone calls with political leaders where other foreign powers are going to be very upset when that happens. So trying to say, well, this was just sort of a offhanded congratulatory call suggests a sort of lack of understanding of the delicate relationship between China and Taiwan and lack of a recognition, perhaps, that China really has pretty strong feelings about Taiwan's place in the world.
Yeah, in fact, Senator Chris Murphy started tweeting the night this happened, this is how wars start. And it's true, right? They can be little things that trigger it. But then, as you know, David, as the week went on, we learned that this call may have been in the works for weeks, that potentially former Senator Bob Dole may have had something to do with setting this up. So now, as opposed to at first wondering, was this something, you know, Trump unwittingly didn't even realize what the quagmire he was stepping into, then there's the thought, oh, no, he knew exactly what he was doing. And because he always has his target set on China, he knew exactly what he wanted to do. Just curious, do you think he knew what he was doing? And if he did know what he was doing, is it a smart move?
Well, that's something that is extremely difficult to answer. He's not always totally forthcoming about what his intentions are and when he's being serious about something and when he's not. My sense is that there's reason for people to feel a little bit uncomfortable when a president-elect who actually hasn't even taken office is taking perhaps provocative steps in the foreign policy domain without consulting with the State Department, without consulting with the current administration. It seems like those types of things, that type of behavior, carry some pretty clear risks. Could it be that this is part of some sort of master plan to throw China off balance? I suppose, but the nature of there are reasons, I guess, why this delicate arrangement has been maintained and viewed as the best course for the last several decades. And so I think regardless of what kinds of secret intentions Trump may claim to have had or what kind of planning purportedly went into this, it's something that I think there are reasons for observers to feel kind of nervous about.
And obviously, listen, he was my guess is he was elected not to be the world's best foreign leader president, but it's all about jobs and all about domestic issues. But you can't ignore the international affairs of the world. Apparently, he had a conversation with the president of the Philippines, who, of course, you know, had some bad moments with President Obama and said some bad things. And but he told him, hey, you know, love the way you're handling your drug war, which apparently the way the president is handling the drug war in the Philippines is he's having drug dealers and drug users killed. And Trump's all on board with that. From what he said, does he get that words have consequences?
Well, it's tough to really say. I mean, some of his advisors and surrogates have been sort of poo-pooing kerfuffles about things that he's tweeted or said, as you know, people are taking his words too seriously or too literally. I think we'll all find out fairly soon that that's what a president has to expect in terms of how his words are going to be taken. They speak from a position of authority when other leaders in the world hear communications from the president. They take them seriously, not as colorful words just meant to stir emotions or evoke imagery. So it's very difficult to say with something like the conversation with the leader of the Philippines, what exactly was happening. Was this part of some sort of intentional strategy that's been deliberated internally within the incoming Trump administration and his advisors? Is this simply a misstep by a foreign policy amateur? Is the what summary, the thumbnail of what the nature of the conversation was, is that actually accurate? We don't really know. And it's certainly the case that some foreign policy is expected to be conducted, you know, not fully in public view where strategies are all given a public airing before they're pursued. But I think part of while there's a lot of nervousness at the State Department and in the current administration is that there seems to be little evidence that there's much of a clear strategy and little evidence of consultation with career diplomats who traditionally would play a key role in briefing the president and talking through the ins and outs of a particular strategy.
Which may be why Senator Chris Murphy also said it's time we get a Secretary of State on board very quickly. Let's go domestic and take a look here. You know, just again this week, Trump, who seems to govern by tweets, that looks like what we're being set up for. I'm not judging it. It just seems to be what he's doing. All of a sudden, the comment comes out. Boeing is making a new Air Force One. It's $4 billion. That's ridiculous. Cancel that contract. All in caps. And of course, Boeing stock immediately starts to drop. You know, again, maybe it's the art of the deal. He's just starting a negotiation process, but he doesn't seem to get that a simple tweet and he's affecting the markets.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is very recent news and it's tough to really know what's behind that. I mean, I personally don't have the expertise to sort out whether a $4 billion contract is outrageous or reasonable.
Nor do I, and I agree with you, and that would never put you in that position. But just the question of the sort of just almost random, you know, kind of comment is really what I'm asking about, the notion of a president who just, whenever he has a whim about something, out it comes in a tweet, and maybe when he was running for president, so be it. It was a Saturday Night Live joke, and of course those jokes still get his tweets. But my point is now, whatever he's commenting on, whatever deal, whatever company, there are consequences to it.
Oh, I would fully agree with that. I mean, again, you know, the president has a great deal of power over our policy apparatus. The words, the communications, the tweets that a president-elect puts out are taken seriously by the market, by foreign leaders, and people respond assuming that those words are meant seriously, not as a way to symbolically convey to the public that you're going to stand up to corporations or government waste or things like that.
Also curious, it's a bit sidestepping of the presidential issue per se, but this the fake news issues that have been so much in the news of recent days, and it looks like it's not going away. A tweet that says somehow Hillary Clinton was operating a sex ring out of a pizza parlor in the Washington, D.C. area. Absolute lunacy. And yet it gets retweeted by Mike Flynn, who's going to be the national security advisor. His son retweets it. Flynn himself was known for tweeting things that were absolutely fake news. That worries me, and I'm curious if it worries you, David, going forward. Are we having a presidency where, well, if we don't like the facts or like what we have, we'll just make stuff up and put that out there and retweet it away, and then it's got a life of its own?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is going to be a domain where I think journalists are going to have to adapt to covering an administration where traditional norms about being careful about what one says and ensuring that one can support one's positions with evidence seems to not be a central motivator. I think the fake news problem is a very serious one. The prospects for us coming together as a country or engaging in productive dialogue are pretty seriously undermined when we can't even agree on basic facts, or when some people come to the table with ideas that are just, you know, as you're suggesting in the most extreme cases, you know, utterly absurd. You know, the notion that there's some sort of conspiracy of millions of voters voting fraudulently, to, you know, these sort of preposterous notions that Clinton and Podesta are running a child sex trafficking ring out of a pizza parlor. I mean, it makes dialogue very, very difficult.
And it makes it worse when leaders or relatives of leaders retweet it to keep it alive. It gives it a sense of truth.
Yes. And I, you know, I would strongly expect that some of those communications are going to end up being important points during some of these Senate confirmation hearings. There are going to be some challenges brought up by the Democrats.
But do you have any sense, David, that any of it? I mean, look, Jeff Sessions, incredibly conservative. Some would say that Dr. Ben Carson is incompetent to be handling the HUD. But the Senate has the votes to pass on every one of those nominations. So even though Elizabeth Warren and some other Democrats are screaming and yelling, the truth is Trump will get the cabinet he nominates.
That's likely to be the case. I would. Nonetheless, there are ways for the Democrats to drag their feet and drag out the hearings extensively, in part perhaps with the hope of putting the brakes on, perhaps stymieing some of Trump's ability to move on more substantive policy matters. But I think ultimately you're right, you know, both with his cabinet appointments and ultimately with Supreme Court nominees, he's going to likely kind of get his way. The question will be whether there's receptivity among some Republicans, perhaps some members of the public, to arguments that some of these individuals are perhaps, you know, have perhaps behaved in ways that are beyond the pale and unacceptable for someone who's expected to be making important high-level decisions.
This ride is just getting going. There's going to be so much more to talk about. Professor David Daugherty of Loyola University of Chicago, appreciate your being with me. And please come back again soon, because I just think that every week we're going to take shifts and shapes and kind of wonder where things are going. And it's going to get real, real fast as soon as we hit Inauguration Day. So please join me again.
Will do. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Well, when you think of theaters in Chicago, which just wear the badge, the crown of saying this is what Chicago theater is all about, my guess is one of the very first names that comes out of your mouth is the Goodman Theater. I mean, the Goodman Theater is so classic to the history of theater in Chicago, and with its wonderful theater on Dearborn I tell you, I've been a subscriber for years and years and years, and what a place of magic that they put on there and have been doing for years. So there's a new season. We're getting ready for a new season at the Goodman Theater, as we are at many theaters, and I wanted to touch base to let you, our listeners, know what lies ahead. So you might want to get a subscription or maybe individual tickets at some of the great stuff that has been going on. Joining me is Steve Scott. He is the producer of Goodman Theater. He's a member of the Goodman's Artistic Collective. He directs so many shows. I actually go around to other theaters, and every time I look up, it's Steve Scott directing another show wherever I am. So it's no wonder he's the recipient of over six, I think, Jeff nominations and After Dark Award. This guy's one of the best in the city. Steve Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Paul. Good to be here.
But we're going to talk about your main hat here over at the Goodman Theater. And this becomes kind of a special year because Robert Falls, the artistic director, he's hitting a milestone.
Yes, he is. He's celebrating his 30th anniversary as our artistic director, which is quite an accomplishment, and he's amassed quite a track record while he's been here.
And yet he's only 40.
Yes, he started when he was in kindergarten. He was a child prodigy.
That shows. Well, you know, I want to tell you, before we get into the new season, I just want to congratulate the theater. You guys always bring stuff in. Just in my mind, I sit and think of some of the grand musicals, Jungle Book. But last season, you did War Paint with Christine Ebersole and
right.
Patti LuPone. That, you talk about a coup in the city of Chicago. That was amazing, and I'm guessing it set some records. I mean, it was huge.
It did very, very well here. It was a wonderful show, and it was a great experience for all of us to be able to work on that. And we're very excited about it moving to Broadway this spring.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can go back and see it again.
I saw it twice already with you, so why not? Hey, as we look at this season, this is really, I think you're calling the season sort of Essential Goodman. I guess in that way it's sort of a tribute to Bob.
Yes, it is. It's really a tribute to all of the work he's done as artistic director in terms of setting a number of priorities for us with new work and with very diverse work and with the rethought classics, all of which are represented in this season, in his 30th anniversary season.
It's one of the more very diverse seasons, I think, that I can recall in recent years. You kicked off. Now, folks have already missed a couple of shows, but we might as well tell them what they missed.
Yeah. We started the season with a wonderful revival of the Leonard Bernstein musical Wonderful Town, yeah, directed by Mary Zimmerman, which was very successful for us and was a lovely production. And then we did the world premiere of a new play called The Magic Play, which is one of the most unusual things we've done and one of the most popular plays we've done in our small Owen Theater. Both of them were very, very successful, and it was a great fall for us.
And we should clarify, for people that haven't been to the Goodman, there are two main theaters there. There's the Albert Theater, which is the grand theater where the Wonderful Towns go and where the War Paints go. And there's the Owen
right.
Theater, which is more of a black box, which really allows you to do very creative, inventive things.
Right, and kind of reinvestigate the space for each show. We kind of redesign the space for every play that we do in there.
So let's go to the Albert Theater, the grand.
All right.
And starting in January, people will be able to see a show called Gloria, which, as I
right.
read about it, I haven't seen that, but it looks scary.
It's actually a wonderful new play by Brandon Jacobs Jenkins, who recently was named to this year's class of MacArthur Fellows. And it premiered last year at the Vineyard Theater in New York. And it is a very interesting play. It deals with a kind of satire of office politics, which
that's
we're
the
all
scary
familiar
part.
With. That's the scary part. And the kind of generational rift that one finds in offices now. And then the office is transformed by a major calamity. And the second act deals with the office workers who are left, who are trying somehow to make this tragedy bankable for them. And it really, really deals with the 21st century urge to commodify disaster and tragedy and turn it into kind of a People magazine story.
And it is a comedy, right? This is a comedy.
It is a comedy. It's very dark, but it's very, very funny. But it's also very wise. I think it's a very trenchant comment on what our world is like today and all the things that we've certainly been experiencing in the last few weeks.
And then if we flop over to the other theater for a little bit in February into the Owen Theater, that black box theater, the creative, let's work with the space theater, Bob goes back to, I think he loves doing Chekhov, and he goes back to a bit of his roots here with Uncle Vanya.
Right, yes. One of his most successful productions during his tenure here was a production several years ago of The Seagull, and he has also did a number of years ago a wonderful production of Three Sisters. Uncle Vanya is a play that he's always wanted to do but has never really tackled until now, and because it's really about the process of aging and how what happens when one gets older and looks back on one's life and successes and failures thereof. It's a beautiful play, and Bob has some very exciting ideas for it. I think it's going to be a wonderful way to mark his anniversary season.
And then we'll walk back down the hallway and go over to the Albert Theater.
Already.
These are separate subscriptions, but I want people to appreciate the fact that you really don't want to miss any of them. And the other thing I think, that Goodman is known for, in my opinion, I mean, there's always, thanks to so many of the folks you have as part of your, you know, collaborative and all that, is a nod to the Latino community. And so we have Destiny of Desire, which is true to that often present theme.
And Destiny of Desire is by Karen Zacharias, a playwright that we've worked with a number of times before. What Karen does in this play is she takes the whole telenovela concept, the very popular soap operas that we see on Spanish language television, and turns it into a kind of a story of America, of these people who have come to America and are kind of pursuing their lives and fortunes in American ways, but within the context of the telenovela kind of heightened grandeur and heightened soap opera. It's really a fascinating play, very, very clever, very funny, but offers some very interesting views of what the immigrant experience really is in America.
And when I think of, because it's in the Albert Theater, are we going to see one of the great grand sets you're known for? I feel like this could call for that.
It's a beautiful set, and it's a set that functions in a number of different ways. So it's one of those sets that turns into a lot of different things through the course of the evening. But it's a lovely production. We actually are co-producing with South Coast Repertory in California. And it originated there and will be moving here in the spring. It's just a stunning piece and really a great deal of fun.
And that's in March and April. And as we continue in March, we're back down the hallway to the Owen Theater and keeping with a nod to culture and to different cultures with King of the Yees.
Right. King of the Yees is a new play by Lauren Yee, which we developed through our New Stages Festival here. And it's a wonderful kind of wacky look at the tradition of the Yee family in San Francisco, based really on her father, and who is the head of the Yee clan, and kind of investigates in some very, very funny ways the whole idea of identity and generational identity and how what's important in one generation may seem to be less important to the next generation. But it's a very affectionate look at all of this and a kind of an interesting new way of examining the whole idea of family and who family is and what we do about family.
And that again in the smaller Owen Theater. We're back in the Albert Theater in April with Objects in the Mirror. Now, this is going to confuse people because the play is written by Charles Smith. It's directed by Chuck Smith.
Yeah.
Are you playing with our mind?
Well, they could be one and the same person because we've never seen them in the same room together, I guess. But no, Charles Smith is a very accomplished writer who is now the head of the playwriting program at Ohio University. And Chuck Smith, of course, is our resident director who's been working with us for 25 years or more. Charles has come up with a fascinating play based on a true story of a young man who fled the civil wars in Liberia and spent the next decade trying to find a new home, through the course of which he also had to don a new identity to keep himself safe. And so the play deals not only with what it is to be kind of torn from your home and have to find someplace else, but what happens when your own identity is compromised and when you have to become someone else through the course of this. It's a very moving piece. Again, it was seen in our New Stages Festival last year in the workshop production, but a really affecting piece about the situation of the world today and what some people have to do to kind of overcome the obstacles of the war-torn Central Africa.
And And what I love about this, you're kind of tossing that out there, but people should realize they can see so many of these shows in the New Stages Festival, which is in the fall, and then so many of these shows actually then end up on main stage.
Yes, yes, and we're already planning next season based on some of the success of the New Stages Festival just a couple months ago.
Fantastic.
But we'll talk about that some other time.
Oh, we will. Now, over in and I'm back in the Owen now. Lady in Denmark, I am really, you got to tell me about this one because it is a tribute, I know, to Billie Holiday. But I,
yes.
But you know, I'm also, I'm sure we're all familiar with you know, the other recent show on Broadway about Lady Day. So how is this different from other shows about Billie Holiday?
It's a show that it's a very interesting piece, also based on a true story by Dale Orlander Smith, and Dale read about a woman who had grown up in Denmark, eventually moved to the United States, but who found great solace after the death of her husband in the songs of Billie Holiday, a woman that she had idolized from the time she was a girl and actually met when Holiday was performing in Denmark in the 1950s. And so it kind of parallels some of the travails that Billie Holiday went through in her life and her career, and the travails that Helena, the only character in Lady in Denmark, finds in her life. But it ultimately, I think, celebrates the great power of art and what art can do to kind of lift you out of yourself and lift you into a context in which you can understand and begin to deal with the things that come down the road that you have to handle. It's really a beautiful piece, a very soulful piece, and a lovely kind of peon to the power of what we do as artists.
But we will get her music, right? That's part of it.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the music plays in the background and sometimes in the foreground, and Billie Holiday is actually a kind of ghost-like character in this play.
Wow.
But it really focuses on Helena's transformation through that music.
Very cool. And then we'll wrap the season back in the Albert Theater. We're in June at this point. But Ah Wilderness, Eugene O'Neill. Again, classic Bob Falls to bring in Eugene O'Neill.
Yes, Bob, I think, through the last 30 years, has become known as probably the primary interpreter of the works of Eugene O'Neill, and he's done several of them with great success here, most recently Iceman Cometh with Nathan Lane.
Amazing, by the way.
Which was an amazing production, and we all felt that. Ah Wilderness is Eugene O'Neill's only comedy, interestingly enough, and it deals basically with a small-town family going through some of the challenges that families go through. A teenage son who is in rebellion, wants to date a girl that nobody is sure he should be dating, wants to grow up more quickly than he is. And how a warm and kind of nurturing family can kind of help this kid deal with all of these things. So it's interesting. O'Neill deals with a lot of the same themes that he deals with in his more serious plays, but here with a much more hopeful touch and a comedic touch. It's really a charming and warm and lovely tribute to the positive powers of family. O'Neill sometimes talks about the negative aspects of family, but here it's a positive experience, and I think a really lovely one and a lovely way to spend the summer at the Goodman Theater.
Well, it's an amazing season coming up, and please give Bob our congratulations for what will be an ongoing tribute to him and his work during this next year. We should mention A Christmas Carol in its 39th year, but everybody knows it's over there. It'll play through the end of the year. But I'll tell you what, if you haven't ever seen Larry Ando play Ebenezer Scrooge, he'll scare the bejeebies out of you. He's great.
One of the great performances I've ever seen.
Yeah, it truly is. I think he's one of Chicago's greatest actors, and so wonderful.
I agree completely.
It's also no wonder, Steve, that the Goodman is known as Time Magazine once called it America's best regional theater. Not one of the best, but America's best regional theater.
We were very proud of that then, and still are. And hopefully, we're maintaining that quality that brought us that accolade.
Well, you are, and it's why you'll see me at all upcoming productions because I can't spend enough time at the Goodman Theater. Steve Scott, thank you for your time, and congratulations on the work that you do there. I look forward to seeing your next endeavors. And everybody check out the Goodman Theater. GoodmanTheater.org is where you can check on tickets and all of that and buy season subscriptions and throw Steve's name in. It'll get you nothing.
They're very good. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Steve. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnick.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.